joining us today on the Culture Catch, the smoothest sportscaster we know, Mr. Bob Costas, next. Today's show is brought to you by our friends at JBL. With over 50 years of producing world-class loudspeakers and electronics, check out JBL.com.
Joining us today on the Culture Catch, we're very honored to have Mr. Bob Costas. I'm a big fan, Bob. Thanks for being on the show.
Dusty, you got your tribe hat in place?
Yeah, you know, by the time they see this, the series will have been over, the World Series would have been over, so we can only hope for the best.
And we will know whether the drought continues. Or whether it's ended. It has 30 years less of agony than the Red Sox, let's say, since 1918.
True. And the Cubbies.
But, yeah. 1908 and
the Cubbies,
and counting. And but 1948's a long time to wait.
It is a long time. I mean, 64 for the last city championship for the Browns, you know.
Yeah.
For having a world championship. And I have to say, I feel rather bullish about Cleveland sports in general. You know, LeBron went to my high school.
Cavs went to the finals.
And he's done very well. Yeah, he was, you know, lit it up. And the Brownies could be turning the corner, although I still think there are some defensive players away from really establishing themselves to another level. Maybe they sneak in this year.
But they're a lot better than people thought.
A lot
coming
better.
Into the
yeah,
season.
Yeah. But enough about me.
All right.
Enough about the tribe. Let's
enough
get
about
in,
the tribe.
How a guy goes from Brooklyn to Comac, Syracuse, then ends up in St. Louis. Take us through that migration. How did you get from Syracuse to St. Louis?
Well, I was in college at Syracuse, and during my senior year, I start doing minor league hockey games in the old Eastern Hockey League, which is the Paul Newman Slapshot League. There were actual guys whose games I had called who were extras in the movie Slapshot, which exaggerated a little, but it was that kind of wild and woolly league where guys would start a fight just out of boredom. Hey, it's the second period. We haven't had a fight. Let's have a fight just for the hell of it. We're men, aren't we? And we'd ride the bus 7 hours from Syracuse to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, 9 or 10 hours to Lewiston, Maine. You'd play a game and turn right around and come back, just ride the bus all night long. And I was doing these games while I was still a senior in college. And it helped to get me in the door at an NBC station in Syracuse, where I worked both radio and television. And I just sent a tape out on a lark to KMOX in St. Louis, which is one of the legendary 50,000-watt radio stations, home of Jack Buck then and the St. Louis Cardinals and every major sport in St. Louis. And somehow, at age 22, I got this job doing the games for the Spirits of St. Louis of the ABA. And then that kind of gave me a platform from which somebody noticed me at NBC, and I went to NBC a few years after that.
That's fantastic. Did you ever think when starting out and doing, you know, slogging through the trenches, as it would be, that you'd get to the next level? Were you content to maybe stay in a local market, or did you have grander visions?
You know, Dusty, this is the honest to God's truth. I had no idea what the next level was beyond the fact that I wanted to do big time college or pro sports, but I thought that radio was the deal. To me, radio announcers were the romantic figures. And if the game was on television, all that meant was that the radio guys slid over and did the TV. You know, if Lindsey Nelson was the radio voice of the Mets, then he did some of the innings on TV.
Right.
Or Mel Allen or Red Barber or Vin Scully or whomever it may have been. So when I landed at KMOX with Jack Buck and these other well-thought-of broadcasters, to me, that was already the top of the line. Maybe you could get better assignments. Maybe someday you'd do the Cardinals or whatever. But I never thought in terms of network television. And when I eventually did, I thought of it in terms of doing play-by-play of baseball or football games, which I did do at NBC. But looking back, the thing that really allowed me to break through was hosting rather than play-by-play. Although people do, and it's very nice, they do remember me, especially doing baseball play-by-play because of my affinity for the game, but primarily what I'm known for is hosting, be it the Olympics or my own program on HBO or now the Football Night shows on NBC.
And do you prefer one over the other? You know, if you were to look at your body of work, do you feel more comfortable doing the play-by-play, or to you does it just come naturally either way?
I think if you made a short list of the things for which I'm rightly known, I think baseball play-by-play would be one of them. Now, I did a lot of football in the early 80s on NBC, and I did some basketball in the late 90s on NBC, and I enjoyed those things, but I wouldn't say they're as definitive for
right.
me. I think probably hosting the Olympics, doing interview-type programs, sports or non-sports, and baseball play-by-play are probably the thing that people know me for.
Right. Would you look back and say Buck was one of your early mentors, or was there somebody else along the way? You know,
just being around Jack Buck was helpful to me.
Right.
And I'm a guy who doesn't believe that any broadcaster should copy another broadcaster. It's a bad idea,
right.
because you'll just wind up being a pale imitation. The West Coast is filled with guys who just sound like a poor man's Vin Scully. And it works for one. It works for the original. It's like every trash-talking tomato can who followed Muhammad Ali just sounds like a hapless dope.
Right.
But the guy who did it was a genius.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
the guy who did it first. So it's better off to say, that's what that guy does.
Right.
You know, and he does it extraordinarily well. But you can learn things without copying them. Mm. You can learn about preparation. You can learn a little bit about timing and pace. You can learn about the importance of a well-placed aside or a clever remark, but not to the point where it overwhelms the broadcast. So there are lots of guys I admire, but I don't think that anyone would say that I'm very much like them. I admire Jim McKay. I admire Vin Scully. I admire Jack Whitaker. I admire Al Michaels now and others. I think Joe Buck, Jack's son, is a very talented young guy. But I have my own approach, and that seems to have worked for me.
Oh, most definitely, most definitely. And, you know, it's funny because you can look at every generation has their voices in sports, and mm-hmm. you're certainly within our age demographic one of those voices, which I think is the greatest honor if you're a broadcaster in sports or
yeah.
in any medium, really, you know, if you're doing that.
When people come up and say, I remember you broadcasting this game or this event that had meaning to me, that I still remember, or I watched it with my dad, or I watched it with my son or daughter. That's very gratifying.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You know, growing up in Ohio, we had the Joe Tates of the world.
Yeah.
You know, you had the regional guys, and you always wondered, were those guys going to break out from that? You know, Joe ultimately ended up in San Francisco, I think, in his latter years. But you wonder if not Joe Tate. What am I saying?
Pete Franklin. Yeah.
When we were growing up, it was Pete yeah. Franklin. Pete Franklin was like one of the first crazy kind of guys.
Yeah, crazy sports talk guy. There's a million of them now.
Now, but back then he was the only guy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you know, I'd get calls from friends who were out of who would get the AM feed. They say this guy is off the hook.
Right.
Why doesn't he have a nationally syndicated show or something?
Mm-hmm.
And now, of course, everyone. You know, I think Berman, when he started doing his ESPN, kind of set a certain mold
yeah.
for that kind of wisecracking guy.
And the problem becomes when you have a handful of guys doing something, it seems fresh and new. Then when everybody follows the same path, even when it's done well, it seems tired.
Right.
You know, there's almost a standard issue attitude now that pervades sports. And how irreverent can it truly be if everybody's doing the same thing? And if it's what you're expected to do. When I first began to be noticed at NBC, I got referred to a lot as irreverent. And I guess there was some irreverence in what I did.
Right.
But I was counterpunching the prevailing tone, which I think made it effective. Now, the way to counterpunch the prevailing tone, more often than not, is to play it straight.
Right.
Because the prevailing tone is like frat house tomfoolery.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a place for that, yeah. but when you overdose on it, I think sometimes the audience is just relieved to have somebody give them the facts.
I couldn't agree more, and I think sometimes it's a little tedious. It really is. When you want to get break it down, give me the reasons the team won or lost. I don't need all the hyperbole, et cetera, et cetera. I think people respect that, too. I think you want to hear sports, and if you're a true fan, you want to get down to the heart of the matter.
Yeah, there's always room for some lightheartedness and some fun, and I hope that it's part of everything that I do, but it ought to be the spice, not the main course.
Right. How about internet radio and the way it's impacting now? Now mm-hmm. I can listen to KNR
yeah.
at home while I'm working, and it's fantastic, and I get all the guys that, you know, I remember, some of which are new,
yeah.
but some of the other guys were there when I was coming out of Akron.
I think it's a boon to sports fans.
Right.
You know, you can follow your local team. You can go on MLB.com. And if you're a displaced Mariners fan and you want to listen to Dave Niehaus, well, you're actually living in Decatur. Bingo.
Yeah.
There he is.
Yeah.
You know, it's a wonderful thing. Be it XM or Sirius carries all of the NFL games, and XM carries all of the baseball games, and then you can just, as you say, you can go online and pick up individual broadcasts. It's tremendous.
It's tremendous. Do you think that there's too much of it? Do you think we're reaching a saturation point? There's so much sports
yeah.
now.
Yeah. You know,
we're losing the specialness of the guys, like you said, Vince Scully and the regional guys. Where
I agree with that. Although fans still, even with all the choices, everything that's out there on cable, everything that's on the networks now, so much more than there used to be, they do still focus on their local team. And so the local announcer still has a special relationship
right.
with the fans in that town and region. So that's still more or less the same. And I think with all this stuff that's out there now, you just have to be a discriminating consumer. You know, you got to say to yourself, just because you're a sports fan, you don't have to prove it by TiVoing Bowling Green against Kent State. It's not necessary. Unless you're an alum of one
right.
of those schools,
right.
it's not going to be on the end of the term test. Leave it alone and read a book or get another couple hours of sleep.
Unless you got a serious book going on that, you know. I don't know.
Well, you know, and without gambling, where would some of these broadcasts be?
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe that fuels that proliferation.
Yeah, you know, I've known compulsive gamblers in my life, and one of the things that was true of almost all of them, if they could see it, they would bet on it.
Mm.
Now, in 1966, that meant the game of the week, couple of football games on Sunday,
right.
and maybe the local games of your team. But now, when you can see dozens and dozens and dozens of games, some of these people must have no relief.
Oh, yeah.
If they can watch it, they got to get some action going on.
Yeah, exactly. And it just, it's never ending, as you said. Who's the most overrated player in sports?
Mm.
Any sports.
I'll tell you what's not overrated. This Izzy soda. Some good stuff right here. Most overrated. Wow. Boy, your question is a whole lot better than my answer, which is a non-answer.
What popped into your mind?
Nothing.
Nothing, really? What's his name has a book out now, and he was talking about the most overrated NFL players, and they mm-hmm. put Joe Willie on that list. They said,
All time.
Yeah. And they said, well, you know, Joe won, you know, he had the big bravado,
yeah.
the big boast, we're going to win, we're going to beat the Colts.
Yeah.
But then if you look at his career stats, he certainly didn't have Hall of Fame stats.
No, he threw, I think, more career interceptions than touchdowns.
Yeah.
But in fairness, Joe was injured from the get-go. He came
Bad
out of
news,
Alabama
yeah. Yeah.
as damaged goods. And if you look at the impact that he had, he's not overrated based on the impact.
Right.
He was at the center of one of the most important games in the history of sports, the Jets beating the Colts in Super Bowl III, gigantic upset. And anybody who ever watched Joe Namath when he was close to his best, he was never 100%, but when he had it going, he was such a dynamic player, and he could single-handedly turn a game around. I think if you're just reading numbers, yeah, he's overrated. But if you experience the impact he had on New York and on pro football during his era, I think you give him his props.
Right, right. Did you ever hear this story about Joe Willie that he didn't have the grades to get into Penn State where he wanted to go,
mm-hmm.
and Paterno called Bear and said, I got a kid for you. Is that true or false? Have you heard that? Is that urban myth?
I have heard that. I can't confirm it, but I've heard that.
Yeah.
He was also a good baseball prospect, Namath, and I think the Cubs were interested in him as well, but it would make sense that a kid from Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, his first choice, his dream, would be to play at Penn State.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so let's go the other way. Who's one of the greatest athletes that ever lived? I mean, we have great records that have been broken.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I were talking about this last night, and I said, who do you think, honey, you know, is there one accomplishment in sports that just is, you know, infinite years away from all other accomplishments? She goes, well, I don't know personally, but I would go to track and field, where it's
yeah.
the individual against the individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, Carl Lewis and all those Olympic gold medals, and doing it in various disciplines, doing it as a sprinter, doing it as a long jumper, doing it as a member of the relay team.
Right.
You could look at someone like Jackie Joyner-Kersee,
mm-hmm.
with the female equivalent
right.
of the decathlon,
right.
you know, winning all those events. It's hard.
Is it Bannister breaking the first 4 minute sub?
Well, when Roger Bannister broke the 4 minute mile in the early 1950s, 53 or 54,
right.
That was a mythic barrier.
Right.
And when somebody does that, it's interesting. No one thinks that whoever holds the present record is necessarily a better miler than Bannister when he broke the 4 minute mile. Lots of guys have run 100 yards or 100 meters faster than Jesse Owens. They don't necessarily occupy a higher spot in the history of the sport. And maybe we should take that into account when we look at other records, including in team sports.
Mm-hmm.
The guy hits 50 home runs today. I don't think that means the same thing as when Willie Mays or Mickey Mantle hit 50 home runs, because the game has changed so much and the conditions are so different.
Right. The athletes have changed.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I was doing a little research, and I forgot about Bob Beamon's long jump, which shattered the world record by 2 feet.
Astonishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 1968 right. at Mexico City, he actually soared past the point where the distances were marked in the pit.
Right.
They had to remeasure it from the launching point to where he landed, and he went over 29 feet, and the existing record was somewhere in the range of 27, and it stood from 1968 to 1991. Usually, records in track and field are broken in tiny increments,
right.
hundredths of a second, fractions of an inch. So this was just completely off the chart, and I was lucky enough to be in Tokyo at the meet a year prior to the 92 Barcelona Olympics, where both Carl Lewis and Mike Powell broke Beamon's record at the same meet in Tokyo. Powell actually won the meet and still holds the record.
Right.
Although he never beat Lewis in Olympic competition. He never won an Olympic gold, but he is still the record holder for the long jump.
Yeah, that's a great one. But remember the controversy. I remember as a kid, I was 11 or 12, and they said, well, it was because the air was thin in Mexico City.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they said that a tribute, but everyone said, 2 feet. I mean, like you said, it's not an incremental measure.
It would be like if somebody, minus steroids, legitimately hit 75 home runs playing for the Red Sox, and someone said, but it's Fenway, and you've got the Green Monster. Okay, you can discount a little,
right.
but you couldn't discount that much.
Right.
I mean, the guy broke the existing record by more than 2 feet.
Yeah. The other one I looked at, I thought was really compelling, and I think it might get overlooked because it's not a popular sport, is Lance Armstrong's 7 Tour de France victories. I mean, staggering what he did in talk about mano y mano. Now, mm-hmm. I know they do shield and everything with their teammates, but still an extraordinary.
That's an unbelievable performance. Al Orter, who just recently died, won his event at the Olympics in 4 consecutive Olympics.
Wow.
56, 60, 64, and 68.
Unbelievable.
At a time when it was truly an amateur pursuit, where
right.
you weren't training, you couldn't train year-round, or if you did, you did it after you came home from work or after you came home from school.
Right.
You know?
You didn't have the corporate sponsors. Yeah. I'm sure there are a few more we're missing. You know, team sports, you could say the hockey, U.S. hockey team in 1980 built
Russians. You know, it's Russians. An individual event.
You're right.
That was one of the most exciting and significant in its time. It's hard to compare it, though, to Tiger Woods trying to overtake Jack Nicklaus. Hard to compare it to
Tiger winning the Masters, though, at 21.
Right, or Wayne Gretzky
just
completely shattering.
Right.
I mean, Wayne Gretzky is to hockey what Babe Ruth was in the context of his time to baseball in terms of not just exceeding, but reshaping and shattering all the existing standards, or what Wilt Chamberlain was at the beginning of his career, where he averaged 50 points a game for a season and had another season where he averaged more than 40.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Let's look at the global icon of sports. You know, I don't think we've had someone since Ali who was truly a world champ, who was beloved in all corners of the globe. Do we have anyone approaching that status?
Well,
is Yao Ming going to get there? Who's going to be the next guy or gal?
I think Michael Jordan was as close as we've come to an Ali.
Right.
Now, Jordan didn't have the social impact of Ali.
Right.
A lot of people identified not only with Ali's boxing exploits, but in some sense, they thought of him as representative of an emerging consciousness.
Mm. Good point.
And a certain political stand, and that gave him additional substance. But in terms of commercial appeal, especially since he came along later and marketing was so much more sophisticated, Jordan was probably as well known because more people had access to images by the 80s and 90s than they did during the prime of Ali's career, be it the internet or television or whatever it may be. Probably more people saw Michael Jordan's face and could identify who he was and what he did, probably even than knew Ali. Yeah.
Who do you think is going to be coming out of?
You know, I would say now Tiger Woods in America is the top guy.
Right.
Obviously, there are entire chunks of the globe that have no interest in golf and have no way to relate to it. So that limits what Tiger's reach is, but he's probably the top guy now.
Right.
You know, if you, I don't know that much about soccer, but
I was going to say
Pele.
Yes,
Pele.
There must be a young soccer guy.
You know, Pele at his peak.
Right.
Or I'm going to reveal my ignorance here. Ronaldinho.
The kid
is a big deal soccer player
the
now.
The young kid. He's like, yeah, or maybe Beckham. I don't know.
Beckham's time has passed as an elite player on the global stage, but since most Americans either don't know that or don't care about it, then he tries to come back for a second life here.
Here's kind of a hypothetical. Does sports drive the media or does media drive sports? You know, or are all bets off now today, as you said,
there's such a
proliferation?
It's an intermingling. It's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing. Pretty clearly, there's so much sports on television now, and it'd be one thing if it was just confined to the games, but surrounding the games, you have sports talk radio, you have the internet and all the blogs, you've got 24/7 ESPN, and much of that time is filled with discussion about sports rather than just showing sports. Now, some of that discussion is very interesting. It's the lifeblood of sports. People have always talked about it in schoolyards and at bars and on street corners, but now you've got all these programs designed to make a big issue out of things that mostly aren't big issues. Is it a worthy discussion whether the Yankees should bring back Joe Torre? Of course it is. But after you've talked about it for a while, all you can do is repeat yourself or give it a disproportionate amount of importance to the point where even those who actually are interested think their head is going to explode. And then you have to, beyond that, since you need to fill this half hour, then the next half hour, and the next half hour, you got to make a big deal out of relatively minor things. So the sense of perspective and proportion is all but completely lost, and everybody gets completely worked up over next to nothing, you know?
Yeah.
And if you can just keep pushing the button that turns up the heat rather than the one that sheds more light, well, we know what we're going to do.
Right, right, exactly. What's your most vivid and memorable sports memory?
My most vivid sports memory as a kid was the first baseball game my dad took me to. First time my dad took me to Yankee Stadium. He actually took me to Ebbets Field and the Polo Grounds in 1957, the last year of the Giants and the Dodgers in New York. But I was only 5 years old, and I just kind of remember it sort of impressionistically. I remember kind of the feel of the place and the colors and sitting on my dad's shoulders to see over the people in front of us, that kind of thing. But the first game that I remember specifics of, 1959 at Yankee Stadium, one of the few years in that era the Yankees did not win the pennant. It was toward the end of the year, and they were playing out the string. It was a Saturday afternoon against the Orioles, and Baltimore won the game 7-2. I still remember that, and to my disappointment, Mickey Mantle didn't play. But what you could do then, they don't let you do it anymore, but fans used to be able to leave by walking around the field. They'd let you walk around the warning track, and then in the dirt area behind the backstop in front of the dugouts and then back all the way around. And Yankee Stadium, which is still a big park, but then it was absolutely massive.
Right, sure.
460 feet to center, 457 to left center. So it was this massive place. And when you're 7 years old holding your dad's hand, it just seems overwhelming. It's just almost too much to take it all in.
Right.
And the idea of walking on the same field, even though you couldn't stand on the field itself, you walked around the warning track. That was pretty awe-inspiring for a kid.
Yeah, sure. Good story. Have you ever been nervous interviewing anyone?
Yeah.
Whether in sports or on your non-sports shows?
Yeah, you know, I think that you get, at least I do, you would have more of a twinge of nervousness if you're interviewing someone who was significant to you when you were younger or iconic from your youth. So I would be more nervous, maybe not enough to be flustered, but enough to feel a little bit of a buzz. More nervous interviewing Ted Williams or Joe DiMaggio or Willie Mays or Hank Aaron than interviewing Ken Griffey Jr. or Roger Clemens. Not because I don't respect them and have high regard for them, but by the time they broke in, I was already doing this for a living. And I'll always be older than they are. So,
meeting your icons.
Yeah. So interviewing Paul McCartney on Later in 1991, at a time when it had been more than 10 years since he had done a sit-down interview on American television, and just thinking of being 11 years old and watching them for the first time on the Ed Sullivan Show, and what a big, big deal that was, and thinking, gee, everyone I went to junior high school and high school with is going to be watching this and hoping that I'll ask all the right questions. And if I screw this up, I'll never hear the end of it.
Did you feel good about the interview?
Yeah, I did. He made it easy. He was very approachable. And once you fed him something, he kind of took off with it and told a lot of good stories.
Oh, that's good. Is there anyone you haven't interviewed yet that you'd love to sit down with?
Well, I never got the real sit down, and now obviously it's not going to happen. Never got the real one with DiMaggio. Mm. I did get little bits and pieces with Joe, and he was always very kind to me personally, but he was evasive. Mm-hmm. He never did an autobiography. He did one like right after he finished playing, but he never did the real story of his life and never wanted to talk about it. So I was unsuccessful with that. A guy that I think would be a very good interview, because so few people now have any mystique surrounding them, because everyone's so available, we know more than really we maybe need to know, to the point where it's not flattering to even the most admirable of people. But Sandy Koufax has retained that kind of distance. So he's one of the few big sports stars that still has true mystique surrounding him. And I respect the fact that he's shy and just doesn't feel like doing it. But that would be one that, if he ever felt like doing it, would be fascinating. Jack Nicholson, outside of sports, is another one. You think about this with Nicholson, he could scarcely be more famous. But if you think about it, you have never seen him interviewed on television. He will occasionally do a magazine piece to promote a movie.
Right.
And you see him at the Laker game.
Right.
You know, but he never sits down and does this. And he's explained to me and others that he feels like it would break the kind of aura that you get on the big screen, but that is diminished if you're available in someone's living room on the small screen.
That's fantastic. Because when you were saying that, I was flashing on when Brando did Larry King.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh my God. Yeah. I don't know if that's how I want to see Brando, especially since it was later in his life.
Right, and he was a little weird at that point.
He was a little weird, and you know, he's kissing Larry on the lips, and you're like, okay, where's this going?
Do we need to see that?
Yeah, exactly. He was a little off-putting.
See, the other one is like J.D. Salinger. All right.
Okay, sure. Never given an interview. Nobody
knows anything. He's still alive.
Yeah.
Right. Every kid from our generation and beyond has read The Catcher in the Rye. All right.
Yeah.
No one knows what he looks like even. Right. And you can't even get a
still
picture of the
once.
Guy. You did.
Yeah, I met his daughter. She was very nice. You know, we talked about this. She goes, I don't even know my father. You know, he was very reclusive even around the family. Writing. He had his own little writing shed, I guess, on the property.
Yeah.
But that's you know, I do like that. You do like to have the veils. You do want to be able to have the folk legend status for some of your heroes, I guess it would be.
Yeah, and I would hope that if I did do an interview with J.D. Salinger, or Harper Lee is another one.
Right.
And my point is not that Harper Lee or J.D. Salinger are at the very top rank of literary figures. They're significant, but obviously there are authors, both contemporaries and in the past, who knowledgeable people would rank ahead of them. But what they have going for them is that their work is so accessible. Every high school kid has read To Kill a Mockingbird or Catcher in the Rye. So they have a personal connection to these authors. And yet these people have never, to my knowledge, given extended radio or television interviews. And I would hope that if I were to do an interview like that, that I would do justice to it and not waste people's time with inane, gossipy, nonsensical stuff, but hope to get them to reveal something about the work that they did and the thoughts and perspective that went into it and what effect it's had on their lives as well as on the lives of all the people that have read it, so that it would further the connection in some way, between them and their audience, rather than obscuring it with all the celebrity nonsense that everyone seems to be obsessed with these days.
I wonder if they're obsessed with it, or if it's just that there's, you know, we don't, there's so many options that sometimes the great programming gets missed.
Yeah.
Because there's just too many choices and you don't know where to zero in.
Yeah, I don't know if this happens to you, but you sit there and you hit the guide or the menu, right? And now you go through it from 2 through maybe 500. And as you're going through it, you're noting the 5 or 6 things that seem interesting. But by the time you've gotten to the end, A, you've forgotten what they were. B, the show is half over. You've
right.
completely screwed yourself
right.
on this, right?
Or they're all on commercial at the same time. How about that?
Right.
The commercial breaks are all synchronized.
I'm
like, guys, let's stagger those because you're going to get more viewers, but you're absolutely right. And then, you know, you just recycle that whole thing over again. I guess TiVo is good in the sense that you can say, okay, at 7 o'clock tonight, I'm going to watch Larry David.
I agree.
Time-shifted content.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little strange. I agree with your original premise, though, that there's a lot of good stuff out there, even though most of it may be dreck.
Right.
Just by the sheer numbers, there's actually more good stuff than there has ever been. I guarantee you that in what used to be called the golden age of television, yeah, there was a lot of great live drama like Playhouse 90 and that sort of thing, but there's more good television now. It may be a smaller percentage of the whole, but if you're a discriminating consumer and you're looking for Ted Koppel gone from ABC but on the Discovery Channel, or you're looking for Ken Burns on PBS, or you're trying to find something on even Comedy Central or whatever, or so many places on the History Channel. And plus, there's a lot of good stuff on network television. Again, if you're discerning
right.
enough, if you're going to spend 6-7 hours a day in front of the television set, you're going to be ingesting a lot of stuff that's mediocre or worse.
Right.
But if you pick and choose, I think it's better than it's ever been.
HBO just seems to be the barometer of good taste. I mean. You know,
especially when it comes to G-String Divas, Taxi Cab Confessions,
well, okay, that's
Real Sex 29,
but
and
that's,
Cat House.
That's after midnight, though. They're very good about. You know,
actually, some of that stuff is amusing.
Some of that stuff is actually amusing.
I don't know about enlightening, but it's amusing.
My wife will come in and she goes, "What are you watching? What are you?" You know, I'm like, "Well, I don't know. This is the Bunny Ranch or." No, but I mean, working for HBO, how is that a different experience than working for the networks for you personally? Is there not much difference?
No, there's a big difference. There's a big difference, you know, and I've had a great experience by and large at NBC, but at HBO, if we're just talking about sports, they have a commitment to journalism, to commentary, to quality that you're just not going to find other places. Bryant Gumbel's show, Real Sports, dozens of HBO sports documentaries. Even inside the NFL has a whole different feel to it than the football shows that you see on Saturday and Sunday on the networks. And even though we have a good time, some percentage of it has some actual journalism to it or some historical aspect to it. And so going there and doing INFL and also Costas Now, I don't think that you could do those programs anywhere else. There's just no place else that would give you that kind of time and let you work with producers and writers who are as committed to quality as I hope I am.
You know, I don't think people really understand the preparation that goes into the show, any of the shows you mm-hmm. work on. Take us through a typical day, because I think people see the end results and they have no idea. They think you have a fairy tale existence. You get to go all of these great games.
And by and large, that's true. I mean, it beats having a real job.
Yeah, of course. And you love it. Yeah. You're very good at it, so you've been able to sustain a career because of your craft. But the actual work day itself, they have no idea about that.
Well, you know, there is
and
no...
And you stay in great shape, yeah, Bob.
There's almost no typical work day. At the Olympics, for example, those are 15-hour days for 3 weeks straight. And lots of reading and preparation for weeks and weeks and months leading up to it. But that's once every other year. Doing the Sunday Night Football show on NBC, during the week you're following what's going on. But in my case, not to the point of knowing who the backup inside linebackers are for the Seahawks.
Right.
You know, I'll find that out if and when I have to find that out. But I have a general idea of what's going on in the league. And then on Sunday, we come in around noon, we go on the air around 7. The whole crew watches all the games together, dozen or so games until we go on the air at 7 o'clock. And a lot of what you're learning, you're kind of taken in by osmosis. But what you have to have, not everybody has it, it's a knack, it's not that important a skill, but it comes in handy on television. You just have to have an ability to do things extemporaneously. Mm-hmm. You have to have an ability to absorb information quickly and be able to turn it around in some way that seems credible,
right.
You know, and to adjust to all the different things that come flying at you in a live situation. I wouldn't equate that with writing an important takeout piece in the New York Times or doing a piece for Ted Koppel's Nightline or for 60 Minutes. It's not nearly as significant or nearly as taxing an undertaking. But it is work. And it's actually a compliment, though, if people watch a broadcaster and they think he or she makes it look easy. And if you're sitting at home watching and go, that this must be as easy as just showing up. Good. Think that. Because you're supposed to be enjoying yourself. And I want you thinking about everything that happens behind the scenes. Fine. If you think it's easy, good.
I think they used to think that, but now that we have the pro athlete crossing over into your profession, we see that it's not the easy transition. And it's very tough for a lot of these guys. And you see the guys who are still in it, they've been able to get, you know, Bradshaw's been able to get to the next level.
Yeah.
You know, and their guys have really worked hard at it, you know, so they've been able to progress.
Yeah, and there's different paths to success. A guy like Bradshaw or Madden, almost bigger than life personalities, Barkley,
right.
You know, there was no pattern or
template.
Yeah, for what they did.
Right.
You know, they just made it up as they went along.
And they were their own guys, basically.
Exactly. But the Jim Nances, the Al Michaels, the Joe Bucks, Dick Enberg, a little bit earlier than that, whomever it may be, whomever you think
Keith
is
Jackson.
Those guys,
yeah.
Had to have a wide range of specific skills. You had to be able to deliver. You had to be at least reasonably articulate. You had to be able to absorb information and make judgments about what was significant, what to emphasize, when to emphasize it, what fits where. So again, it isn't brain surgery, and in the course of the history of Western civilization, it's not going to amount to much. But it is a much more specific and considerable set of skills than the average person may realize.
How about Cosell, Howard Cosell?
Mixed bag, very, very significant in his time, significant as a performer.
Right.
Leave aside whatever journalism or commentary was involved. He was an over-the-top performer. And at that time, when there were fewer things on television, he was identified with so much that was on that people watched, so much significant stuff, be it Monday Night Football or Ali's fights or whatever it may have been in Wide World of Sports. And his voice and his appearance were so different from anybody else on television that even non-sports fans knew who he was. He was simultaneously the most liked and disliked broadcaster in every poll. That happened year after year. And just about anybody could do a Howard Cosell impression, which is one measure of cultural impact, pop
right.
culture impact. Now, Howard fancied himself as something more than just an entertainer, a sometimes over-the-top entertainer. He fancied himself a journalist and a deep thinker. And in his best moments, he was. But Howard wanted you to think that he could have been a member of the U.S. Senate, or for that matter, he could have done Ted Koppel or Walter Cronkite's job. And I think maybe some of the very things that sometimes made Howard amusing actually would have brought him up short in those roles, because it just would have been too much,
right.
You know, just kind of overbearing.
Yeah. What do you do to unwind? Do you have any time, or are you just sports 24/7?
Oh, God, it's not sports 24/7.
Thank God.
You know, you couldn't do it.
Right.
You'd be, I guess there are people who do it.
I mean, you're very well read, and you've had these non-sports shows, so obviously you're culturally
I enjoy sports. I enjoy the anticipation of a big event, the atmosphere surrounding a big event, the opportunities for humor and kind of a shared experience. It's all good. It's been an important part of my life. But if I ever get to the point where I genuinely am obsessed with who the Buccaneers will take in the fourth round, please just take me out back and shoot me. Take my wretched life and end it.
All right, what are you reading right now? Non-sports related.
You know, actually, what was the last thing, what have I been reading? Because I have to read lots of periodicals, you know, and I have to read lots of newspaper stuff that does deal, you know, with preparation. What is the last, you've got me stymied. The last book I read, I think, was The Catcher in the Rye or To Kill a Mockingbird, really. And that's my entire literary canon. That's all I've got. Do you have a problem with that?
Come on, none of Oprah's Book of the Month selections? Not a Grisham or a Stephen King novel?
You know, Grisham's latest book, Playing for Pizza, someone just sent it to me, probably Grisham's publisher, about like some washed-up football player who winds up playing quarterback in some semi-pro league in Italy.
Sounds good. In Italy?
Yeah.
I didn't even know the Italians had...
Neither did I. He's Playing for Pizza. And if and when I ever read it, I'll give you a book report.
All right, we'll get
but
it on
the But it's nothing against Grisham that I haven't read it.
How about the transient nature of sports today, Bob? You know, I've got two young ones. And my 9-year-old mm-hmm. son, it's just like, how does he... Is he just going to be rooting for the corporate team and not have, you know, the A-Rod that may stay, you know, it's very frustrating for me.
Yeah,
I had Rocky Colavito, I had Sudden Sam McDowell, Louis Tiant.
Right.
You know, I hold those memories like you hold your memories for the Yankees,
yep.
the mantle.
You know, a lot of people have said, I'm not the first to say it, that now you root for the uniform as much as you do for individuals. Or if individuals show up, you root for them and you understand they've got a period of time where they wear this uniform. The next wave of Hall of Famers in baseball is going to be the first wave where true Hall of Fame guys have played for 4, 5, 6 teams. You used to occasionally have a guy toward the end of his career. I mean, even Willie Mays played a couple of years with the Mets toward the end of his career. Or maybe somebody like Babe Ruth, who began his career with one team and then it entered a different stage and he really took off with the Yankees, but it was unheard of for the greatest players to be just jumping from team to team until recently. But I think that your kids and mine are less jolted by that than we are because they're not connected to the previous model. It is what it is, you know? So if you're a Patriot fan and now you got Randy Moss, fine, you know?
It just means another ring.
Yeah.
Another celebration,
I guess. I always kind of marveled at the Chicago Bulls fans who, when Dennis Rodman played for the Pistons and tried to decapitate Scottie Pippen, when he played for San Antonio and undercut John Stockton and other people, they labeled Dennis Rodman as a dirty player, which he was, in addition to being a very clever and effective player. He was often a dirty player and an instigator, and beyond that, one of the weirdest human beings on the planet, and that's how they saw him. When he came to the Bulls and could help them win championships, suddenly they decided, most of them, that how you felt about Rodman was some kind of referendum on how open-minded you were and how accepting of eccentrics you were. So your Rodman pro or con was a litmus test about whether you were liberal or conservative. This was moronic, but it kind of fits in with the way sports fans think. Well, he's our guy now.
Yeah, it's fine. Anything he did in the past, we forgive him.
He's our guy now.
Yeah. Where do you get your wit?
You know,
your mother, your father, your siblings?
My father was a sarcastic and humorous guy. I have one sibling, a sister, who's fairly amusing. There was always kind of spirited banter around the house, and I was always a fan of comedians on television, whatever. That's not to say that I'm in that league, but I tend to take an ironic view of things, and I tend to see the absurdity in it, including the absurdity in my own situation and in my own persona. The thing I try to do, however, is to remember that humor or an aside that may put a smile on somebody's face is the side dish. It's not the main thing that you do. Sportscasters who give the impression that this game or this broadcast is only here to serve as a platform for my performance, hey, look at me, I think they're going down the wrong path, and they need to get their ass to the Chuckle Hut in Akron and off the air. If that's what you're really there to do, okay, then declare that and go, right? I think that, I hope that there's some lightheartedness and some smiles in almost everything I do. There may be some things where it wouldn't be appropriate, but in almost everything I do. But not to the point where it detracts from the main reason you're there, which is to cover the event or to dispense the information.
Good answer. We didn't talk about extreme sports at all. Mm-hmm. You know, and a whole new generation has a whole new set of heroes. Baseball is baseball still America's favorite pastime? I mean, we've got so much.
You know,
Ultimate Fighting and this, that.
Yeah. Well, of the established sports, it's very clear that in every measurable way, football has moved past baseball as the most popular sport. On the other hand, you could still say that baseball is America's pastime because with so few games, every football game feels like a big event or a spectacle. And outside of the All-Star game and the playoffs, baseball is kind of a meandering season-long story of 162 games, and you pass part of your time in the spring and summer following your team and following the game. And the economic indicators of baseball are better now than any time in the last 10, 15 years. So the game is still strong. I don't know that it'll ever overtake football again as the number one spectator sport. But I guess you could say that football is the most popular American sport, but baseball is still the pastime, if we make that distinction.
But are we looking at, you know, TV revenue and ad, you know, because you could say, you make the argument, well, the ads during the Super Bowl are the most most expensive ads on network television.
And they are. Yeah.
So are we measuring that way? Or are we really measuring viewership? Is football, you know, if you collectively look at the Cleveland Browns season versus the Cleveland Indians season, are there bigger numbers?
Well, if you cobble together all the local ratings, the cable ratings, the network ratings of baseball games over the course of a season, then more people are watching those games because there's 10 times as many games.
Right.
And if you count attendance over the course of a season,
no
team is going to draw 4 million or 3 million in the NFL. There's not enough games and there's not enough seats. On the other hand, one measure is this. If the Cowboys played the Patriots in the Super Bowl, that might take the rating from a 43 to a 46. But it's going to be over a 40 no matter what because it's the Super Bowl. Now, if the Cubs had played the Yankees or the Red Sox in this year's World Series, and if the series went six or seven games, the number would be enormous by World Series standards.
Right.
On the other hand, and we don't know what it is as we speak, but if the Indians play the Diamondbacks, with all due respect to those teams and those markets, it'll be appreciably smaller. Just as White Sox Astros was appreciably smaller, then on top of that it was a sweep.
Right.
So you've got a swing based on the teams involved, based on how competitive the series is. You've got a swing in World Series ratings, whereas with football, you can pencil in the 40 plus no matter who plays in the Super Bowl.
Good point, very good point. Okay, I'm sold. you have your Mickey Mantle card?
You know what? This is an embarrassing...
Because people don't know this about you.
Well, I think I've told this story so many times, or people have asked me about it so many times, that there's only about 11% of all living Americans who don't know the story, leaving the other 89% to scream at the top of their lungs right now, Bob, come up with a new story. But it's a true story, and
it's
you asked.
It's a great story.
So I've carried this 1958 Mickey Mantle Topps bubblegum card since it came out of the pack of baseball cards when I was 6 years old. For the past 2 weeks, as you know, Dusty, I split my time, in addition to other outposts on the road, between New York and St. Louis. 2 weeks ago, I'm home in St. Louis, and I know where I left it. It's on the inside pocket of a sport coat hanging in the closet in St. Louis. Thousands of times over the years since this was revealed, people will either ask me on shows or just strangers on the street will ask if I've got the Mantle card.
Yeah.
You are the third person who has asked, not today, but over the last week, the third person who's asked, and I've had to cop to it that I don't have it on me. You've caught me.
I'm nearly naked, Bob Costas, here on Culture Catch.
That's,
but I did look, and it's placed.
You've exposed that I have not read a book since I was in high school, other than a sports book. And that the whole Mantle story is a crock of crap.
Oh, geez. Isn't it tough, the internet, how we can just... We can.
Who do you have here?
Vic Davalio.
Ooh, Vic Davalio. We love Vic Davalio.
These are my 1967 cards, and my favorite card of all time, Sudden Sam McDowell.
Sudden Sam McDowell.
And look at that pose. I mean, you just don't find that pose today.
And you know what was great about baseball cards then?
Remember flipping cards?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if kids still flip baseball cards.
Well, when they get the card, they're interested in the monetary value. And the monetary value is diminished if it's not in mint condition.
Yeah, so you have to get it in the sleeve.
So you're not going to flip them or scale them. Yeah. We used to play Knock-A-Lena. You take it and lean it up against the wall, at the base of the wall, like this, and then you'd scale other cards to try and knock it down. And every card that failed to do so became part of the ever-growing pot.
Right.
You know, you could clean a guy's whole shoebox out.
You could take him out. You could take him out.
And then other times you just flip him and try to match him, heads or tails or whatever. But what was always great was the little cartoon on the back. So Vic led the Indians with 26 stolen bases in 1965. So here's the, you know, understand the context. It's 1967 for this card.
67 card, right.
So here's the culturally insensitive drawing
of a Native American
that depicts Vic Davalio, an Hispanic baseball player, suddenly as a Native American, who appears to be sort of creeping up to steal a base while wearing his moccasins. Of course, Chief Wahoo still has his. We've opened up a Pandora's box.
Yes, exactly. That's another show
of cultural objections. Let's see what we have here.
He's got the two panel because he was a superstar.
He's got a two panel, and at this point, my eyesight is insufficient. What does Sam's card say? They always have his season's performance.
There you go.
See if these will help. No, they don't help at all because I have my contact lenses in. Good God. How are you going to conclude this? This seems ragged to me, Dusty.
The tape's going to run out in a minute.
The tape's going to run out. What time is it?
Bob, I want to thank you, truly for being on the show. I'm a
for
big
just,
fan.
For coming on and just rambling.
Rambling.
Until the
this tape
is ran
what
out.
The internet is about, man.
Yeah.
And then I can edit the and Richard can edit the hell out of this and make you.
Richard, edit out the part which exposed me as a functional illiterate. Would you do that, please? edit out the part that says that I have not read a book since
we're
Gone
send
with
you
the
some,
Wind.
No, we're going to send you some books.
Dale, thank you.
We have a swag bag of books.
Oh, good, good.
By Christmas.
They'll look good in the bookcase. It impresses visitors without my having actually to intellectually exert myself.
You can re-gift them to your colleagues.
Yeah.
No, thanks a lot.
All right.
We'll see you soon. This is Dusty
Wright
and Bob Costas.
Want to thank today's guest, Mr. Bob Costas. And, of course, our friends at JBL for sponsoring this podcast. You've been listening to Culture Kit. I'm Dusty Wright. And don't forget, if you like our shows, please leave a comment at iTunes. And visit us online at culturecatch.com for plenty of written reviews and video podcasts. We'll see you down the road. Converge is the word.